Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We've all seen the bumper sticker, Baby on Board, but what about Baby in Bed, your bed? Many more American parents are now letting their children share their beds. Rockabye Baby is now Rockabye Mom and Dad, and maybe brother and sister too. Co-sleeping is hot. So hot, Banana Republic incorporated the theme into its holiday ads with images of a family swathed in cashmere nightwear sleeping peacefully on one wide bed. Proponents of co-sleeping say it's natural. Critics call it dangerous. This hour On Point, co-sleeping, America's new bedtime story. We begin with a look at a new federal study and the spike in co-sleeping numbers. Donald G. McNeil Jr. is a science reporter with the New York Times. I asked him to describe the co-sleeping surge.
Well, it seems to have gone, according to a federal study, from about 6% in 1993 to a little more than 12% in the year 2000.
That's a large increase in not too many years.
Yeah, it's about doubling.
Who did the study and how did they do it?
It was the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. And it was actually part of a bigger study that they did about whether infants are put down to sleep on their stomach, on their back, or on their side, because sleeping on your back is actually considered considerably safer as far as sudden infant death syndrome or crib death is concerned.
And how did the researchers respond to this doubling in infant children sleeping with their parents? Is it an impressive increase to people in the field?
The funny thing is the researchers who did the study themselves never asked any questions about why people did this. And so they didn't really want to give reasons why it had increased. They were very reluctant to draw conclusions from their own study. But if you call up other sleep experts around the country, they're pretty eager to offer conclusions.
We'll look at those conclusions, but tell us first, how do the numbers break down? Is there variation by race, by class, by ethnicity?
Yeah, there's big variation by race and class. Blacks tend to have children sleeping in the bed with them. If you average the number of years, it gets to be 28% for blacks, 21% for Asians, 12% for Hispanics, and about 7% for whites. But the whites had the biggest growth over the period 1993 to 2000. The reasons, like I said, this wasn't something that the researchers themselves looked into, but other sleep experts said it's more common in African-American families because the families are often poorer and there are fewer beds in the house, so the infant is more likely to sleep with his parents. A baby is more likely to be in the bed with the mother when the mother is under 18 years old. A baby is more likely to be in the bed with an adult when the family earns less than $20,000 a year.
Almost twice as likely at that level of near poverty.
Exactly. But on the other hand, these trends don't hold true across the board. It's not just poor families who are doing it. According to the sleep experts from outside, I mean, they say that it's breastfeeding has had a dramatic increase in the United States. Now about 70% of the women who leave hospitals leave breastfeeding. And so breastfeeding mothers often find it easier to keep the child in the bed with them and to wake up slightly, nurse, and then sort of fall asleep. One of the things that's kind of interesting is that some people worry that mothers would get less sleep. In fact, one of the researchers I talked to said that they tend to get more sleep
if they're sleeping with the children.
If they're sleeping with the child, because they instead of having to get up, haul themselves into another room, pick the baby up out of the crib, nurse the baby, put the baby back, try to get the baby to go back to sleep, and then go back to their own room, they just roll over, nurse the baby, and fall asleep again. So, yes, they're woken up more often, but they also spend less time lying there trying to go back to sleep.
Asians and Latin Americans also tend, if I understand correctly, to sleep with their infants more often. Why?
I have heard that, particularly in Indian families, there's a habit of the family bed. One of the experts I talked to said that she'd spoken to an Indian scientist who said, look, you know, my family slept together until I left home when I was 22 years old. I slept next to my father a lot at night, and we have a very close relationship nowadays. Most men would be horrified by that kind of thing, you know, Westerners, but it's not uncommon in my country.
And how do pediatricians and child psychologists look at this? I guess traditionally the kind of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant norm was to put the baby in a crib in a separate room, and that would be that. Are there advantages, disadvantages, dangers in having the infant in the bed?
Well, it depends completely on who you talk to. You have to remember that picking a baby up and putting it in a crib in a separate room is something that's only happened for the last 200 or 300 years, and is basically sort of a European and American thing. So saying what's the norm. You might have to wipe out 150,000 years of human history in order to arrive at what you think
right.
of the norm
right.
As of 2003 United States. Some pediatricians who have done studies of babies suffocated at night and of crib death say that they think this is likely to increase suffocation. Other pediatricians take exactly the opposite point of view and say that crib deaths happen when children choke to death on their own carbon dioxide or on regurgitated formula or from unexplained reasons when they're alone, and that a mother in bed with the child is much more likely to, one, put the child down in the right position and, two, realize that the child might be having a problem. On the psychological issue, one of the prominent media pediatricians, Dr. Sears, is very, very big on keeping your infant and even your children in the same room with you, and thinks it contributes to the well-being of a child, that a child who gets to sleep next to its parents feels secure and loved and looked after, and that the mother and father get the same sort of feeling of security and lack of worry about the baby's welfare. I didn't speak to anybody who thinks it's psychologically harmful, but I hear there are people who think that.
I can't help thinking of something else that you wrote, that some working parents at all income levels seem to be trying to regain hours of closeness with their children at night, in sleep, that they lose by being away at work all day.
Yeah, that was something that somebody who studied this at the University of Notre Dame told me, that parents feel that they get to spend very little time with their kids. They leave early in the morning and come back late at night, and one way to spend more time with the child is to sleep with it.
Donald McNeil, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Donald McNeil is a science reporter with the New York Times. He spoke with us earlier from New York. We're talking tonight about the crowded family bed, parents and kids sleeping under the same covers. Are you co-sleeping with the kids these days? How's it going? Does co-sleeping sound all warm and fuzzy, or like a sharp little elbow in the neck? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio tonight is Dr. Joshua Sparrow. He's a child psychiatrist and co-author of three new books about child rearing, Calming the Fussy Baby, Sleep and Discipline, The Brazelton Way. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Joshua Sparrow.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being in. And with us from Larchmont, New York tonight, Andrea Barbalik, executive editor of Child Magazine. Andrea, thanks so much for joining us.
Hello. Thank you.
And with us tonight from South Bend, Indiana, James McKenna, director of the Mother Baby Behavioral Sleep Laboratory at the University of Notre Dame. Good evening and welcome, James McKenna.
Good evening, everybody.
James McKenna, take us in here first, if you would. Your institute has done a lot of research on parents and children and infants, mothers and infants in particular, sleeping together. Do these new numbers in the federal survey make sense to you? Do they reflect what you see?
Completely. In fact, if anything, the actual study by Marion Willinger actually showed that, for the most part, it was about 12% that were routinely all night, every night, sleeping with their babies. Mm-hmm. But when one considers the more normative pattern, that babies share part of the night with their parents, it's about 50 to 60%.
Now, we have to acknowledge that in terms of sleeping with the parents all the time, for the general average, they're saying 12.8% is still a great minority, but it's grown hugely. What do you attribute this to, James McKenna?
I think it's several things. It's not one thing, and it's very different for every family, of course. But likely it is, indeed, in the more middle-class white population. It has to do with a tremendous historic high in breastfeeding. Not only is it the case, and I was the one that Mr. McNeil was speaking with about these rates, that's mm-hmm. what I study it in relationship, co-sleeping in relationship to breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. Not only is it 70% leaving the hospital breastfeeding, but at 6 months, it's about now 32 to 33% where mothers are still breastfeeding. And breastfeeding is having an enormous impact on the proximity that babies have to their mothers during sleep. You know, it's kind of a decision. What we're finding in our studies, and we've been studying this now, excuse me, for about 10 years, mm-hmm. is that in part the decision for women to breastfeed is actually becoming unknowingly at some points a decision to sleep close, if not bed share, with the baby for at least part or half of the night.
Mm-hmm. Andrea Barbalik, you're top editor at Child Magazine, and co-sleeping has been a big topic, I know, for your readers. How are they weighing in? What do people say? A lot of more people are doing it. What's the conversation about it?
The conversation is about whether to do it, whether to not do it. It is on the rise, and I agree that there are a number of different reasons for this. I think that one of the big reasons is that parents are tired, and it was said earlier that you'd think you'd get less sleep if the baby was in bed with you, but nursing or otherwise, you know, the baby likes to be near the parents, and the baby will often sleep better and the parent will get more sleep. And, you know, these days, mothers are getting discharged quickly from the hospital. They go home. They don't have as much help as women did in previous generations, mm-hmm. and they need their sleep.
So there's one answer, just plain tired. And yet it's a big change from what we've seen historically. What's the nature of the dialogue between readers of your magazine about the advisability of this? We'll look at the scientific report, but mothers, fathers, parents, what are they saying to each other? Are some people, shocked by this? Are others saying this is absolutely the way to go?
Well, I think people realize that they need to follow their own instincts, and they're trying to make this decision on their own. People are concerned about safety. They are concerned about the suffocation hazard, but oddly enough, as the safety problems have become more well known, the ways to prevent the problems have become equally publicized, so that people feel that they know how to prevent the problems from happening if they do want to have their baby in bed with them. One thing that happens that we hear our readers talking about a lot is they feel fine having the baby with them for a short time when they're an infant, and then there comes a day when they suddenly realize that no one's getting much sleep anymore.
And out you go, baby doll.
The baby gets bigger. Mm-hmm. The mother isn't nursing around the clock anymore.
Right, right.
You know, when the baby is young, the baby nurses every 2 hours, every 3 hours.
Andrea Barbalik, you've also written about this notion of attachment parenting,
right,
about parents who just want to be welded to that infant in all circumstances when they get the chance. What's that about?
Well, attachment parenting is what was mentioned earlier, is promoted by Dr. Sears and others. And it's an approach to parenting that emphasizes being sensitive to the needs of the child. And some of the things that are promoted are co-sleeping, breastfeeding on demand, baby wearing, carrying the baby in a sling.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that you help the baby feel secure and attached to you, and eventually the baby becomes, you know, secure and safe in the world and happy and independent eventually. And that is a notion that really is on the rise, and I think this is attributing to some of the increase in co-sleeping.
A little counterintuitive in that by keeping your baby close, the
right
presumption is that the baby's ultimately more self-assured. Dr. Joshua Sparrow, you're the child psychiatrist here. How do you look at this? How significant is co-sleeping? Does it have the potential for great advantage, for great harm? Is it a neutral in your mind? How much difference does it make in the psychological development of the child?
Well, I suspect that there are probably more white middle-class parents who are co-sleeping than the reports picked up, because many don't dare to admit. And if you've seen a rise...
Why? Because they think it's just not socially acceptable?
That's right. And I think in some of the other cultures, it's been acceptable all the way back.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the way parents were brought up themselves. And so it's easier for them to say that's what we do, because they always did. So I suspect that there's even more of it going on than people are ready to admit. I think one of the interesting things is that in some of the traditional cultures where families have slept together for centuries, the cultures are oriented not so much towards the individual, but more to the group. So mm-hmm. when you see a practice like this reemerging in our culture, when in fact we're so much more individualistic, you have to wonder if there won't be other adjustments in some of the other ways that we raise our children, and if we're actually just responding to new pressures on parents who, as we've heard, are tired and worn out and want more sleep, or if it represents something even more important than that.
Well, and maybe that's something more important being a kind of time famine, creating a hunger for intimacy that can't be entirely slaked during the waking hours.
Exactly.
In a nutshell, we'll come back to this, but a net psychiatric benefit, psychological plus, or not?
You know, I don't think that it's really up to us to make that call. I think it's really a family's decision, and it depends on what kind of vision they have for the world they want to raise their children for.
Ooh, that raises a big horizon. We've got to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk about all of it. We're looking tonight at co-sleeping, about the surge in children sharing the parents' bed and the search for intimacy in the life of the American family. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. What do you think? Do you co-sleep? Do the kids share the parental bed in your house? And does it sound warm and fuzzy to you, or not quite right? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
In the middle of a dream, stay in bed, alone.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about co-sleeping, about the surge in American children sharing their parents' bed, and the search for intimacy in the life of the American family. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. Does a daytime deficit of time together mean a new nighttime of cuddling? Is a separate bed in a separate room for Junior starting to sound cold and Victorian? And why are American families snoozing together? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are James McKenna from the Mother Baby Behavioral Sleep Laboratory at Notre Dame, Andrea Barbalik, executive editor of Child Magazine, and in the studio with me tonight, Dr. Joshua Sparrow, child psychiatrist and assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. Let's turn to them. Karen's calling from Algoma, Wisconsin. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi there. I have been a mother for 7 years, and
right.
I have three children.
Okay.
They are aged almost 7, 4, and 1.
And where do they sleep, Karen?
They all sleep in the same bed with us. My husband and I have two giant beds pushed up together in our room.
7, 4, and 1, and mom and dad makes 5.
That's correct.
Good Lord. What size are these beds? We want to get specific here. Are they queen, king, double?
Well, actually, we have used a bunch of different combinations. Currently, we have two king-size beds pushed together, but we've also done it with two queens or with a king and a double.
Why do you do it? How do you do it?
It began with the crib having a wall taken off of it and pushed right up to the bed when we had my daughter, Allison.
Okay,
and
makeshift.
It began for ease of breastfeeding and getting more sleep at night. I got a lot more rest when I could just pull her over into bed with me and nurse her back to sleep than when I was getting up and attending to her at night.
And even now, you've got them all there. Doesn't the 7-year-old put a heel in your jaw sometimes in the middle of the night?
My children do tend to poke at their dad if they sleep next to him, but he makes a point to sleep on the other side of me.
The guy always figures out how to game the system.
He doesn't get poked. But, you know, he is a huge advocate of the family bed, and neither of us started out thinking that we were going to be part of the family bed.
What do the neighbors think, Karen? What do your parents think, your friends? Do they think you're nuts or a pioneer?
You know, we've found a lot of friends who are making similar choices or are respectful of the choices that we are making. And I wanted to tell you that when you mentioned that it was counterintuitive to attachment parent.
I was wondering aloud. What do you think?
I think it's actually counter-logical. It makes not a lot of sense in our very independence-oriented society to attachment parent, but I think it's actually very intuitive.
Oh, I didn't mean to say that I found attachment parenting counterintuitive, but the notion, and it, when you think about it, it does make sense, of course, that by keeping the child close in infancy, they may be more independent in adulthood, because I think the traditional thinking, and James McKenna, let me bring you in here if I may,
yes.
I think the traditional thinking was that we instill independence by putting baby boy or girl in their own bed, in their own room, and shutting the door.
Absolutely, and actually, you made some really good observations that the first studies, actual longitudinal studies, are beginning to come out, one of which is a major one. One has already been published by Paul Akami in Developmental Pediatrics.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And what we're finding is it's turning conventional wisdom on its head, and that is just as you would logically think, the babies that have had healthy social relationships during the day and affirmed and mm-hmm. enhanced by nighttime caregiving actually proved to be the most independent and autonomous at 3, 4, 5, and then later. Not only that, but are able to handle their stress in much more mature ways. Not only that, but it's been, you know, armchair theorized that mm-hmm. children that sleep with their parents through the years will have weak sexual identities and body issues, et cetera.
That was a theory. And,
right?
And the findings?
And the refereed papers suggest the opposite. They're actually more secure in their sexual and gender identities, more comfortable with their body images, and more comfortable with being touched and affection.
Karen, Karen of the five in bed, I guess since we've got you, we have to ask you, how does romance fit into this?
You know, romance is very flexible and doesn't happen in the bed where other people are sleeping. And my husband and I are very close to each other, and I think that family sleeping has made us all closer to each other. My husband and I still manage to find time together that is not with the children, but we can parent them to mm-hmm. sleep and then have time for ourselves afterwards.
So romance is the movable feast in this picture. I guess I have to ask you one other question, Karen, because the numbers from this new study say Young single mothers do this in greater proportion. Poor families do this. African-American, Latino, and Asian families do it in greater proportion than whites. But you sound white. How do you fit in culturally? I don't know if you're white or not. It's a bad assumption. But
we are. I mean, we are part, I guess, of the minority of co-sleepers, as you're saying. But we are a middle-class white couple, and we have three children who happen to sleep together. I also wanted to mention that my children are so close to each other. And, yes, of course, they have their arguments like anybody else's. But I mm-hmm. definitely think that sibling relationships are very enhanced by the opportunity to sleep close to each other. And my children love to cuddle together, and they go and find each other in the nighttime if I put them a little far. Sometimes I put my baby a little bit
right.
separate so that they won't roll over on her, and she goes to find them in her sleep. She will crawl up to them and cuddle to them in her sleep.
Karen and Clan, cuddle on, and thank you for your call. Dr. Sparrow, you're the doctor. What do you make of it? Karen sounds very happy with the bed of five.
She does. I love your idea of a movable feast. We heard from one mother this suggestion that if you have all of the children in your bed, you can just go to one of the children's bedrooms when yeah. you want to be romantic.
If you still have the children's bedrooms. Andrea Barbalik, chime in here. Five in the bed, lots of beds shoved together. Everybody just a happy pile of human arms, legs, and the rest.
Well, you know, the bottom line is it seems to be working for that family. You know, the kids are happy, the parents are happy. Who are we to say?
And the county child care supervisor is not going to show up knocking on the door and saying this doesn't fit our Victorian sensibility?
No.
Well, and good for that. James McKenna, you heard Karen talking about the benefits that she
right.
sees, and you began to describe some, but take us through. You've done close observation of mothers
right.
and infants in bed together. What did you learn in that observation?
Well, we've studied them for 20 years with the backing of NICHD, and I have a PhD, if that matters, just in your studio audience.
Oh, we laud and praise you.
No. It's just for credentials.
We got it. We're just kidding.
I've studied this long enough to know that the important thing is, while I could now presently use in my support of the choice, the informed choice to co-sleep, mm-hmm. I could actually use empirical evidence suggesting that psychological development of children are really enhanced by co-sleeping. But, you know, the truth of it isn't where children sleep that is the most determining factor mm-hmm. in the complexity of factors that create personality, character, and intimacy and the nature of someone's mental health. What I generally tell parents from our studies is that co-sleeping can enhance that which is already good that's brought mm-hmm. from the kinds and natures of relationships parents and children have during the day and simply brought into the bed. Because really, it isn't the location, it's the nature, content, and meaning of the relationships in the bed that matter. I suppose the alternative to that is, of course, that if the nature of the relationships between the parent and children are negative or bad or unhealthy during the day, those negative relationships would only be enhanced during the night. So we've got to stop thinking that somehow sleep location determines moral character and the psychological construction of adults. It's much more complex than that.
It's tough to get away from. Let's listen to our callers. Jennifer's calling from Bedford, Massachusetts. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well, thanks.
I was calling, and I'm a mother, a full-time working mother.
Okay.
With a five-year-old, and I have twin eight-month-olds.
Oh, you've got your hands
wow.
full.
Yeah, and I have to say I tripped guiltily into sleeping with my children and love it, especially because I was breastfeeding all of them but the twins now.
Right, and the five-year-old as well, so the twins plus the five-year-old.
No, so I'm not breastfeeding this five-year-old.
No, but I mean, but are they all in the family bed?
They are now, but I guess I have a couple questions mm-hmm. and a few comments.
Yes.
One of the things that I think is really intriguing by this is I didn't quite realize how much of a trend it was towards sleeping with your children.
Yes.
Because I find that it's something that not everybody, at least in the Northeast, maybe it's a Northeast mentality, really embraces.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that it seems to be more acceptable with my babies, but it's been harder for me as with my five-year-old as she gets older and older to know sort of whether it's appropriate for her to still be sleeping with us or, you know, am I somehow...
Is it going to sound funny when she...
Or
is it going to sound funny when she tells her friends at school?
Right, Right, exactly.
And I guess, Jennifer, hang on, I guess we should be very clear about this. It's still overall, as I understand this latest study, 12.8% of families that do this, but then, you know, that's a pretty big minority. What's catching people's attention is how fast that number is rising, more than doubling in just 7 years, and many estimates that it's actually much higher, and in many ethnic communities already much higher. James McKenna, how do you break down the social acceptance, and then what's the ethnic profile here, or the cultural, socioeconomic profile where we're most likely to see co-sleeping?
Well, I'll tell you a story. When we tried to do our big NIH study in Southern California, mm-hmm. we originally started with whites, Asians, and Latinos.
Okay.
We changed the nature of the population to Latinos, but we couldn't really find enough people that were exclusively sleeping alone. That is, we wanted to study two groups, those that exclusively were solitary breastfeeding mom-baby pairs and then exclusively breastfeeding bed-sharing pairs.
Yes.
And if you had asked us at that point, we would have thought, is there anybody that isn't sleeping with their baby? And I've heard other researchers say the same thing.
You mean among ethnic? Is there any ethnic group where it simply does not happen?
Group, every mm-hmm. group right
mm-hmm.
now,
right.
middle class, whites, and Asians lead the way in many ways in terms of my intuitive understanding because it's such an embedded tradition of mothers and babies and grandparents sleeping together. It's mm-hmm. very South Asian, mm-hmm. but it's also very Latino.
Mm-hmm.
The point I'm trying to make is that my colleague in England determined that unless you ask the parent, you know, where the baby is relocated to during the night, what parents generally answer is where the baby is supposed to sleep or where the
yeah.
baby is initially laid down for sleep, but not where the baby ends up.
Really sleeps. And Joshua Sparrow, what about Jennifer's specific question? She's now watching her 5-year-old. And wondering what will the 5-year-old think growing up in a culture where this is perhaps the habit of a minority of families. And does it create strangeness for the 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old coming into their own as a young person when and if this comes up in a social setting and they explain, hey, we sleep together?
You know, I've talked to a lot of families who co-sleep, and most often you hear that each family ends up deciding when one child or another is ready to move out of the family bed based on all kinds of personal decisions. And
right.
it's unfortunate to think that the deciding factor would be social pressure. But I think that she's right to consider what it means to the child. It might be an opportunity for her to be encouraged to be a leader rather than a follower. And if sleeping together with a family is still something that makes sense for her and for the family, it might be something that she could stand up for.
But is there an age, as a child psychiatrist looking on, is there an age at which it is no longer appropriate for a child to stay in the family bed?
I think it's really an individual matter. When you listen to families, they have stories that vary. Sometimes 4 months is the age because that's when babies can put their sleep cycles together and make it more easily on their own. Lots of families say the time is when a new baby comes along, and there are reasons why that can be especially tough on the older child.
But a 7-year-old, a 9-year-old, a 12-year-old, where are we going here?
And sometimes you even hear that kids are ready to move out of the bed when they want to masturbate.
Yeah, they might be looking for privacy then.
That's right.
Andrea Barbalik, what's your sense of the social profile? And by the way, Jennifer, thank you so much for your call. Andrea, what's your sense of the social profile, the cultural profile of where this is catching on or is most deeply embedded?
Well, it's just to get back to Jennifer's question for 1 second,
yes.
I think her older child will probably let her know when the time is right.
Mm-hmm.
When
she's ready to strike out for her own bed.
Yeah, that child will probably ask for his or her own room at
mm-hmm.
some point.
Mm-hmm. And what about the numbers that say that more low-income families have the family bed, more single young mothers have the family bed by large margins?
Well, I think that as you said earlier, you know, sometimes it is an issue of a lack of enough beds for everyone.
Right. Mm-hmm. Just an economic issue.
Yeah, mm-hmm. sometimes.
Fair enough.
And other times, you know, in single-parent households, whether the mother is young or not, if there's not another person in the house, you know, maybe you're more likely to sleep with the child.
It may seem simply too strange to sleep apart when there's only the two.
Right.
Heather's calling from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi, Heather. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm 41, and I'm white, and I'm a mother of 3,
okay.
7, 4, and 10 months. I'm a long-term breastfeeder. That means I breastfeed to 1 to 2 or more years.
Yep.
And I wanted to make 2 points because I take a lot of flack for having my kids in my bed.
They're all three still in the bed, right up to the 7-year-old.
No, I've got, well, it's, usually, yes, but the 7-year-old and the 4-year-old sleep together.
Heather, one more question. Are you single or married?
No, I'm married.
Okay.
I'm married.
So the husband's there, too?
He's here, too.
In the bed.
Well, you know, we all migrate at times.
Yeah.
Musical bed.
Right.
You know, we call it a fluid situation.
Okay, I'm sorry. I've interrupted you too much, but you're saying you catch flack sometimes.
I catch a lot of flack for the long-term breastfeeding and also for the bed sharing. And so I found two reasons in my reading, two supports that have really shut people up, basically, when arguing with me. And these are the two reasons. I also have some insights into why it's growing.
Yeah.
But first, the two reasons. The first is, hey, grown-ups want to snuggle up with a warm, cuddly body at night.
Mm-hmm.
And who better deserves that warmth, love, and security than a child?
Well, fair enough.
Okay,
and does that satisfy your critics?
Well, that's number one. Okay. If that doesn't work,
yep,
then I go to number two. And number two is, I believe I've read that we're the only land mammals that make separate nests for their young.
Ooh, that sounds primordial.
It does. And I actually had a doctor say to me once, well, isn't that because we're higher evolved?
I see. So we're walking tall, we're looking over the swaying grasses of the prairie and making our own beds.
Can I add something to that?
James McKenna, please.
As an anthropologist, and that's what I am, one of the reasons that got me into this business when I had my own son, the reality of what I've been studying in anthropology, I studied monkeys and apes and cross-cultural patterns of mother-infant relationships.
Mm-hmm.
When I really started reading it, I couldn't believe that the most neurologically undeveloped primate of all, the slowest developing, and the most dependent on the caregiver for physical regulation and
mm-hmm.
social development for the longest period of time in its life, was the only one that was being recommended to sleep apart from sensory exchanges with its parents.
That is the human species.
Oh, absolutely. And what my studies previous to this had shown is that even for monkey infants, it's not just social loss from the mother. It is heart rate changes, body hormones change it, body temperature drops when separated from the mother. It's physiological regulation. So that's what prompted me when I started my studies in 1982, seeking NIH funding to look at the physiological differences. And indeed, what we found when babies sleep with their mothers, they sleep and breathe more regularly. Their heart rate exhibits more healthy variability. They spend more time in the lighter stages of sleep, which actually for babies at that age is, in my opinion, safer because it prevents them from spending too much a period of time in the deepest stages of sleep from which arousal to protect themselves from apneas is possible.
James McKenna, hold it there. Heather, you're getting a load of support tonight, whatever you may get on Main Street. Thank you so much for your call. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about co-sleeping and the surge in children sharing their parents' bed. We're going to come back and talk about safety and what happens to romance in your house when the papoose is on board. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Need no other loving, babe. Go to sleep, you little babe.
Go to sleep, you little babe.
Go to sleep, you little babe.
Go to sleep, you little babe.
Come lay.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about co-sleeping, about a surge in American children sharing their parents' bed, and maybe about the search for intimacy in the life of the American family. Does this co-sleeping sound appealing to you, or like a sharp little elbow in the neck, or both? And are you ready for the family bed? Is co-sleeping the wisdom of our ancestors? We're at 1-800-423-8255 tonight. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got a lot of callers and a lot of support from our guest for co-sleeping, but I want to go straight at the safety issue. I don't know exactly where this stands today, but we pulled down a report from the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission, whatever that is, from 1999, warning that against placing babies in adult beds. It said that they found 64 deaths each year from suffocation, strangulation. They said suffocation associated with co-sleeping of adult and baby, suffocation where an infant becomes entrapped or wedged between mattress and another object, suffocation due to airway obstruction when baby is face down on a waterbed, suffocation in rails or openings, This all sounds pretty creepy, Dr. Joshua Sparrow. That could scare a parent right away from co-sleeping, whatever they thought about the psychological benefits.
Yeah, it was pretty scary when that came out. I looked at that actually when I was working on our book on sleep, and I noticed that the co-sponsor of the study was the Juvenile Products Manufacturers Association, and those are the folks who may have a vested interest in bashing co-sleeping because they sell cribs. I do think that there certainly is a public service in pointing out the kinds of hazards that can be avoided. But when you read the study, they had things like babies rolling out of beds into buckets and drowning. And certainly, you know, that's not due to co-sleeping itself, but things that can really be prevented.
But this is not just one trade organization co-sponsored study, this concern, is it? We read Dr. Bradley Thatch, professor of pediatrics at Washington University School of Medicine, saying he's in the camp that thinks it's dangerous. He's done studies in infant deaths in St. Louis. And there are others out there. James McKenna, what about the safety question?
Well, it's a fascinating issue, and it really reveals where the biases in our culture lie. When a baby dies from an unsafe condition in a crib, from a soft mattress, or if a baby is placed prone, which is a dangerous way for a baby to sleep in a crib, the cause of the baby dying in the crib is said either to be the baby sleeping prone or from a soft mattress.
Mm-hmm.
When a baby dies sleeping prone in a bed, as was true for Dr. Thatch's and Dr. Kemp's study, if a baby is found sleeping prone in an adult bed, or on a soft mattress in an adult bed, or if the mother is smoking or taking drugs in an adult bed, the cause of the death is said to have been bed sharing, as opposed to the causes and the specific factors.
Well, a stoned mother in a separate bed would not be a danger, presumably, or not the same kind of danger.
No, that's correct. And let me point out, too, that it's really interesting that every catastrophic rare bed sharing death is used as an indictment against bed sharing, while every crib death represents a tragedy and a problem to be solved. Now, they're all tragedies.
A mystery.
And one has to regard what are the preventive measures, as Dr. Sparrow,
yes,
said. And that's really exactly the point. There are safety precautions in every environment, and actually, both environments require, for the most part, the same kinds of safety precautions.
But what about just plain rolling over on the infant? Wouldn't that be easy to do? Adults are much larger. A night is long.
Well, if that was really true, none of us would be here having this discussion, because the only way human infants ever existed and lived through hundreds of thousands of years was by sleeping next to their mothers and breastfeeding.
Well, I don't know about none of us. I mean, we have evolved through a pretty heavy attrition rate.
Well, that's correct. But the point is, and no biological system is perfect, and babies do die sleeping alone. In fact, 92% of that very paper that you cited, mm-hmm, were babies sleeping alone, where the asphyxiation occurred without adult supervision.
So our group tonight is not really buying the physical accidental death problem. Andrea Barbalik, I want to ask you about, I guess, another issue. We've had a very warm and fuzzy focus on this tonight, but we all know that there can be child abuse issues when adults and children are in proximity. Is that a safety issue for children?
Well, I don't know that that's really the thing that people get most worried about in terms of co-sleeping. Really, what people are concerned about is the child suffocating and a parent possibly rolling over on a child. And, you know, as Dr. McKenna said earlier, there are safety precautions that you can follow if you do decide to co-sleep. The American Academy of Pediatrics cautions against co-sleeping.
Well, actually, they don't caution against it.
They don't support it.
That's true.
I should say.
Does that mean they're neutral?
They're trying to be neutral on it, but they do advise that if families decide to co-sleep, mm-hmm, that they always put the baby on her back. They make sure the baby isn't overheated.
Mm-hmm.
They avoid soft bedding, avoid loose covers, keep the bed away from anything that could trap the baby,
mm-hmm,
and parents should never smoke, drink, or take drugs, any kind of drug,
while they're sleeping with
anything
with
else
their children
that could affect their ability to wake up.
Well, that certainly sounds reasonable. We have a lot of callers who want to come in. Let's try to get a few more. Linda's calling from Exeter, New Hampshire. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well, thanks.
I've been listening for a while, and it just seems like the general consensus is that it's a good idea, but it's funny because my mother, I guess she must have been not a rebel, but she did a lot of the things that are popular for families to do now, which is I slept in her bed. And
in what decade, Linda?
In the 50s.
Okay.
And I'm not really a proponent for that in a way. I'm not saying that it's a bad thing to have a baby in your bed, but I ended up having to sleep with my mother until I was older and always felt almost like I had been raped.
I can hear the tension in your voice. Did you feel, were you sexually abused?
I feel like I was. I feel like, well, my parents were married at first, and then my father left when I was about 2.5, but I feel like she used me to get closeness where she didn't have a man in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, even to this day, I don't feel like, I mean, I do date men, but I felt almost like I was a man.
So it has not left you feeling comfortable and self-assured, at least on the sexual front. Dr. Sparrow, how about it? This is a tough story. And entirely imaginable. I mean, one parent or the other loses the company of the spouse. The child is there. Humans like physical intimacy.
That's why I think it's so important not to use the co-sleeping issue as another source for pressure for parents to believe that there's really one right way of doing things and that to be the perfect parent, which of course none of us will ever be, you've got to follow one recipe or another.
But I'm not sure what you mean in Linda's case.
Well, in Linda's case, what was missed, among other things, is what the meaning of the co-sleeping was to the child. And I think we heard from Dr. McKenna earlier that what is more important is the nature of the relationship between the parent and the child and the spirit in which the co-sleeping takes place. And in this case, it seems pretty clear that what was missed was this woman's mother noticing what it meant to the child. And that's so much more important than having a recipe of it's being good for all or bad for all.
Well, but it sounds like in Linda's case, she found a real potential pitfall. Linda, our time's running short, but thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story. Our time is running down. Let's see if we can get one more call. Chris is calling from Lynn. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to say I'm a mother of 1 3-month-old. I am 29.
Okay.
My husband and I love our son very much. However, I stopped co-sleeping at about 6 weeks, and I am full-time breastfeeding. My husband and I feel that our bed is our private space, and while attachment parenting is great, we also feel that our son does need his own space as well.
So enough is enough. There are some limits, and let him have his bed in his room.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. And we love him and nurture him in every other way, but at night, you know, we do put him in a crib, and he seems perfectly happy to us. He's a very happy little boy.
Chris, I our time's running so short, but I guess you still represent the majority, and I thank you for calling in with your voice. I'm sorry we're going to have to go here. Andrea Barbalik, a final thought. Do you expect to see more of this?
I think it may rise a little bit more, and I think the important thing for people to keep in mind is to do what's right for their family.
And James McKenna, your thought?
To quote Sheila Kitzinger, who said, there's no one right way to raise a baby. There's lots of right ways, and I think we've just pretty much defended one of many choices that parents can make.
So in or out of the family bed is all right, but you see advantages there. Joshua Sparrow.
And I see it as really a family's decision.
Mm-hmm. So make it on your own. And many people are. And the beds are full. Joshua Sparrow in the studio tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Dr. Joshua Sparrow is co-author with T. Barry Brazelton of Calming the Fussy Baby, Sleep and Discipline, The Brazelton Way. Andrea Barbalik joining us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Andrea Barbalik is executive editor of Child Magazine. And in South Bend, Indiana, James McKenna, heading up the Mother Baby Behavioral Sleep Laboratory at the University of Notre Dame. Thanks for being with us. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. This is On Point. Filmmaker Misty Barnes is one of thousands of independent filmmakers whose film will not be shown at the Sundance Film Festival over the next 10 days, but her film, Exposed, will be shown at one of 12 alternative festivals that have sprung up in Park City, Utah. After years of frustration about not having her work seen, Misty is launching the She Dance Festival this year as a venue for the work of women filmmakers, screenwriters, and producers, including her own film. In this radio diary, Misty discusses her film and what motivated her to make it.
The story, Exposed, is about three women icons. They're broadcasting icons. They're all on TV shows in the broadcasting industry, very powerful women, and they're up for the biggest award that broadcasting offers. It's called the Woman of Distinction Award. And a show called Probe, which is sort of a hard copy meets Entertainment Tonight, is doing a story on these women in the 2 weeks before the award ceremony. And the women, who are pretty slick and very knowledgeable, always manage to stay a step ahead of this reporter. And so he never really quite gets the story that he wants to.
This is Probe, a corporate-funded carnival for the masses, a bloody spectacle of egos from celebrities to politicians. Those other guys give you the news you need. I give you news you want. Journalism, Vegas style.
The point was to sort of look at the line between truth and spin, to look at women and how they handle power and competition, and how women have been continually on this cycle to have and be everything. And in order to do that, we sacrifice a lot. But it's really about how they choose to handle the power that they've been given, and then also how we as an audience look at these people that are incredible positions of power.
Eric told me about the new magazine. Congratulations, you're formally an empire.
No, thanks. Kudos to you.
Number one for 20 weeks.
America today is 100% better since you signed on.
Thank you. You know, I think it's silly for us to see this as a competition.
Absolutely. Three women fighting over a tiara.
How unevolved.
I agree. To hell with competition.
Hear, hear.
I have found that, like the film, women tend to be a lot more subversive or covert about the competition when they enter into it. One of my characters says, you know, competition, to hell with competition. I don't really care. It's just an honor to be nominated, which we know is baloney. Whenever I see someone who says, I'm just honored to be nominated, I automatically want to gag because I know that that's not true. Winning is so important. And especially in this industry, winning is everything. But women seem to still refuse to acknowledge it. And I think when we're that covert about acknowledging those things, you have a lot of what I think is humor and satire, but also a lot of maligning and people being what could be construed as pretty cruel and backstabbing. I think that on some level it's just because there's a fear to speak about the competition. And I don't pretend to know what the answer is. I'm just merely shining a light on this whole realm of women in competition and in these positions of power. When we don't talk about something existing, it becomes a much bigger problem. And again, I don't know the answer. I don't say we should get rid of these award shows, but I like to poke fun at them because I think that's the only way we lessen them. When everyone's struggling for 5 minutes of fame, no matter what the cost to their soul, to everyone else, or to their personal lives, we've got a big problem. I don't consider myself a particularly political person, but I do think we have to look at these things. And as an artist, I do take responsibility. And I do think that my job is, if you will, to shine the light on some things.
Misty Barnes is a filmmaker living in Los Angeles. Her film, Exposed, will be shown at the first annual She Dance Festival this weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is W.